WBAI New York at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. It's 7 a.m. in New York. Coming up next is What's Going On with Bob Henley.
There's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Picket lines and picket signs. Don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see.
Good morning, New York and New Jersey, as well as the great world beyond. This is Bob Henley at Stuck Nation, because we surely are. This is a thoughtful Tuesday edition of What's Going On, the Peace and Labor Report. Michael G. Haskins is our audio engineer. Sunrise was at 5:26 a.m. Sunset will be at 8:31 p.m. Right now it's 71 degrees under sunny skies, headed up to 90 degrees. Tomorrow we'll break into the low 90s with a 60% chance of scattered thunderstorms. Thursday, we're in the mid-60s to mid-80s range under a mix of sun and clouds. Friday, the heat backs off a bit as we drop back into the 70s with the sun shining. Over the weekend, we're in the 70s and 80s with scattered showers. New York City's air quality index is 52, or moderate, which means that sensitive groups with pre-existing respiratory or coronary issues should reduce outdoor exercise and wear a mask. I got my eye on you EMTs and other job titles that, well, you know, pay is low and you're still out there and you don't want to expire before you retire. Be sure to look in on your elderly neighbors, because the combination of high temperatures and degraded air quality can be life-threatening. In the A block, we're going to speak with Michael Mogru, president of the United Federation of Teachers, who notified the Municipal Labor Committee on Sunday his union was withdrawing its support from a controversial Medicare Advantage plan, as well as from, quote, the current healthcare negotiations for in-service and pre-Medicare retirees, close quote, with the Adams administration. The bombshell news came in the form of a letter that Mogru sent to Harry Nispoli, the chair of the Municipal Labor Committee and leader of the city's largest Department of Sanitation union. Early this month, Mogru was dealt the defeat when members of the United Caucus, which supported the Medicare Advantage strategy the UFT promoted, were soundly defeated in a leadership election for the UFT's retired teachers chapter. Yeah, their retirees get to vote. That's interesting. They were defeated by the retiree advocate slate, which was expressly created to shut down the mandatory shift to the for-profit Medicare Advantage plan. Proponents of the shift touted a $600 million annual savings, which could help the city maintain premium-free health care for active or in-service members. Resistance to the proposal to shift 250,000 New York City retired civil servants onto a private Medicare Advantage plan spawned almost instantaneously back during Mayor de Blasio's tenure with the formation of the New York City Organization of Public Service Retirees, a racially and economically diverse coalition with tens of thousands of members that has already won several rounds in the courts that have ruled the city's past commitments to its retirees as active employees were still binding. In the B block, we'll have Dr. Simonetta Sambataro from the Doctors' Council at SEIU. She'll be joined by Dr. Runa Ray. The Doctors' Council represents thousands of physicians working at New York City Health and Hospitals Corporation, the municipal network of 11 acute care hospitals and 30 Gotham health centers, is the largest in the nation and provides health care to all, no matter their immigration or economic status, in essence, a form of municipal universal health care. That's right. That's going on in this city of New York. The Doctors' Council's contract lapsed last year, and you will hear from our panel about how an ongoing staffing retention and recruiting crisis is coinciding with a 20% spike in emergency room visits and admissions. All of that and your calls at 212-209-2877. But first, we go to Washington for the Pacifica Network News.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We're willing to hire the best attorneys to fight them in court with all the shenanigans they're playing, with all the anomalies we've seen happen.
Nevada Republican Party Chair Michael McDonald had vowed to fight the criminal charges he tried to overturn former President Donald Trump's 2020 loss in the state. The fake electors case against McDonald and five others has been dismissed by a state judge, saying prosecutors filed in the wrong county. Democrats say they want to appeal. Courts in Arizona, Georgia, and Michigan are considering similar cases. Officials in Milwaukee say people will be allowed to carry guns within blocks of the Republican National Convention next month. U.S. Secret Service Director Kimberly Cheadle says local officials can't alter Wisconsin gun laws for the event, but weapons will be banned within the convention's perimeter.
Previous experience and extensive preparation all contribute to a level of confidence ahead of this convention. We have been busy preparing for any possible scenario, including planned and pop-up demonstrations.
Protesters have been offered two outdoor stages, one within sight of the convention arena. More than 100 organizations have applied to demonstrate so far. North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper has vetoed a bill making it illegal to wear a mask in public, but for reasons tied to campaign finance. Democratic State Representative Tim Longest says an amendment to the bill would undo some limits on dark money groups.
Billionaire donors who want to buy our state elections, but who don't want the public to know what they are doing or who they are giving to, will be able to use these out-of-state entities to funnel money to the committees of these top candidates.
Democrats say the changes are meant to bolster fundraising for the GOP's far-right gubernatorial candidate, Mark Robinson, who has so far raised only half as much as his Democratic opponent. While House Republicans make claims about non-citizens voting in federal elections, some right-wing groups are targeting municipalities that do let them cast ballots in local races. A new lawsuit claims Burlington is violating the Vermont Constitution by letting non-citizens vote in school board races. But State Representative Hal Colston says both the legislature and a majority of voters approved the law.
This is the local control that Vermont champions. This is the local democracy that other states covet.
The Justice Department says the state of Alaska is violating the Americans with Disabilities Act by not providing accessible voting machines or polling places. Kenai, Alaska resident Maggie Winston tells Alaska News Source that often means a lack of privacy for voters with physical challenges.
It would be great as an adult to be able to independently vote without having to tell someone who I'm voting for.
I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Thanks so much, Catherine. I did have to tell you, we get up very early here to bring this to you. An overnight moved word in the New York Times headline, Julian Assange agrees to plead guilty in exchange for release, ending standoff with the United States, barring last-minute snags. The deal would bring to an end a prolonged battle that began after the WikiLeaks founder became alternately celebrated and reviled for revealing state secrets in the 2010s. I'm sure Democracy Now! Will have more on that. Of course, so it's an honor and privilege to invite Michael Mogro, president of the UFT, to these microphones. Good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Nice to talk to you this morning. Beautiful morning out.
Yeah, it is. And so I guess I still go to City Hall and cover things. And it was not long ago that you had a landmark contract settlement with Mayor Adams. And so what happened?
Contracts are collective bargaining issues. And, it's not that anything happened. It's just that we feel that, we're not dealing directly with the mayor. We deal with the Office of Labor Relations, the Office of OMB, the business office, the financial side of the city. And the city's actions have made this impossible to do any sort of healthcare work at this point. Between the court cases, and the last one, that decision was pretty brutal towards the city. And between what we're dealing with now as we try to, we always are negotiating healthcare at all times. It's not like it's a stagnant thing. We do it on a yearly basis. We do it on a monthly basis. We're always trying to figure out things since we became much more aggressive towards the healthcare industry about 14 years ago now. We feel that my union feels we no longer have a willing partner with the city to do the work the right way, which is to really be aggressive towards the healthcare industry. And contracts are contracts. We needed a contract. You know, all city unions need a contract because we're all dealing with large shortages. You know, the city workforce is down over 20,000, and that's affecting services. It's affecting us in the classrooms. So that's good business for the city to do those contracts, especially now since they have such a large amount of surplus and the revenue is quite good, especially since the latest reports have shown it's even growing faster than anyone thought. But facts are facts. This has dragged on too long. So for the Medicare Advantage, it is something we don't believe is possible to do anymore because there is so much anxiety and damage that has been done that let's treat our retirees with respect. The courts have spoken. My members have spoken. Let's move forward. But we have to get back to doing healthcare with the city the way we were doing it before, which is all working together against the healthcare industry, not against the workers.
So one of the things that's interesting feature, I don't believe from my work as the chief leader, I was there for several years, talk about this internal democracy thing. I guess the PSC that represents, of course, the folks that are involved with CUNY, and you all have this it's an anomaly where retirees get to vote. And so you did have quite a turnout there. Can you talk about what role does that play in how you choose to go forward? And I guess democracy in this essence was operating.
Yeah, I mean, I've always been astounded about how the UFT really has a unique retiree program. We believe they should vote. For years, people yelled at us for allowing them to vote. And we just believe we're a stronger union with our retirees having the ability to vote. And when you have votes, you need to listen because that's your member saying directly to you, this is a problem. 3 years ago, we still had Medicare Advantage, and the majority of folks seemed to say, all right, it seems that we'll take this on your word that we can move forward. But since then, it's been nothing but court cases and the city's fumbling the ball and all of this crazy information going on. And that's it. So you listen to them. But for us, it's our retirees are one of the strongest political units of any union in the country. I don't think people understand that. Our retirees actively work all over the place when people need support, whether it's in Nevada or Pennsylvania or down in Florida or North Carolina, South Carolina. Our retirees will help. And I've always thought other unions should follow that, but they seem not to want to do that. But we are very strong believers that our retirees are a vibrant part of our union, whether they're in service, that's what we say in service, most people would understand that as active, or they're retired. And we're not going to change that because we believe in it it's very, very strong for having a union that really respects its folks who have retired, and they give back the same respect by doing all sorts of political work on our behalf.
I want to go back a bit because I think the stage was set for some of the challenges that the unions had. And this goes back to my period of time at WNYC during the 12 years of Mayor Bloomberg. I can't help but to feel that, to be fair to Mayor de Blasio, that there was a kind of scarcity and real hostility for Michael Bloomberg. I remember crossing him at these Q&As when you guys went without a contract. And that was true of every union. And I can't help but feel that period of time of just shut down, just absolutely, that was destructive. And that to some degree, it set the stage for what Bill de Blasio had to dig out from. Am I wrong?
No, that's absolutely right. We were the union that went the longest without a contract. Except for some small unions, especially the ferry, the people who work on the Staten Island Ferry.
Right, MEBA, yay.
listen, Michael Bloomberg had one position on healthcare. You should all be paying premiums just like everybody else. That was his position. That was not something we were willing to entertain. And in terms of us, in terms of contracts, we know that all he wanted to do was get us to agree to a provision that would basically make every UFT member working in a school an at-will employee. And once it was clear that's where he was, it was like, okay, we're not doing this. We're going to war. And, you know, that went over 5 years. De Blasio came in, and right before he came in, you're correct. Everyone was writing stories about it. There was no way for De Blasio to be able to dig out of this hole. Right? So that was the stories right before. And then within, I believe within 8 months, almost every union had their contract done. And that was a great testament to him. But at the same time, De Blasio did recognize rightfully, he said, if we just keep going with the status quo on healthcare, we're gonna land up in the same hole as everyone else. Because it's clear that every year we're getting double-digit inflationary numbers from hospitals. Remember, the insurance companies negotiate individually with each hospital. But every hospital was coming in. Maybe it was 8% or 11%, but they were all coming in with double digits. The insurance companies were coming in with double-digit increases. The group providers were coming in with double-digit increases. And De Blasio's called me and he said, can we come up with a different paradigm where we're actually trying to dig into this until we get some sort of federal intervention? And of course I jumped at the opportunity because it was the right thing to do, and the whole MLC jumped at it. And during the De Blasio years, we were constantly making changes in our healthcare for our actives in service, and nobody, there was no drama around it, and we weren't diminishing any benefits. We were actually just getting aggressive with the three big entities in healthcare, and they were kind of taken aback because they couldn't believe. They're like, why are the unions and their top leadership involved with all of our negotiations all of a sudden? Because we said we're not going to do this. We're not doing business as usual. It's a stacked deck, and you all keep getting richer, and the workers are going to get poorer. So we saved over $3 billion during that period of time.
Is that in terms of avoided costs? I want to understand. Is that in terms of things you didn't spend?
It was basically saying that, you know, they're coming in with 10% increases, and we're like, no, we're negotiating. We're not accepting a 2 or 3% decrease. We want the real deal here. We're going after it for everyone. So we put pressure on everyone. So the savings were money the city did not have to pay, that the city was on the hook to pay.
Avoided costs, in other words, right.
Well, see, this is where I'm going to, because I always hear from the people at the city, like, well, that shouldn't be considered savings because it wasn't money we spent and got back. I'm like, yeah, but if we didn't do that work, you wouldn't have gotten. You would have had to spend that money. So this has been a big debate for years with us and the people at OMB for the city. Because they use this accounting principle called zero sum. And I'm just like, well, if you could have went and done that work on your own, why didn't you do it? We went and did it, and you now don't have to pay it. So guess what? It's savings. And De Blasio saw it that way also. But OMB never always disliked it.
So I'm wondering, what is the story with the Health Stabilization Fund? What was that all about? There was like $1 billion in that transition from Bloomberg into De Blasio?
So it's a formula that was designed in the 80s. It really doesn't work anymore, right? It was all about that we have two basic contracts for all city workers, two premium-free contracts. There's a HIP contract and a GHI contract. And it was always about how you can equalize if one becomes more expensive than the other. So what was going on there is that we said, all right, let's try to get them closer to equal. And then because when they're not equal, the city would have to pay a certain amount of money. I know people have always said these crazy theories about it, but it was just, you know, De Blasio said, if we don't have to pay that money, we're fine. So they did not have to pay $1 billion. So that's where the $1 billion people talk about, the stabilization fund. But part of the other part that people, I don't think people, I don't, I'm assuming almost nobody knows, is that when we started this work together, we all agreed that we had to come up with something different than the stabilization fund because it's not working. Because it's just becoming a game. So we went into that with good faith. But at this point, the stabilization fund is still in existence where with the same rules from, you know, 1980. And we have to change it because there is a fund inside of it which covers all of our, you know, our most expensive drugs, but they're really for our people, members who are really dealing with health crisis. And that has to be, we have been very clear that we want that to be part of whatever we're doing moving forward, because that fund has to be completely protected. And that's something we were trying to work out with the in-service was to, basically encapsulate that in whatever we're doing and keep that safe forever. Because, again, those are workers and retirees, some of our retirees who are really dealing with a health crisis, and those drug costs will cripple them. And we don't want that ever to happen.
So what I'm curious about is, it must have been troublesome in a way that, because of the scarcity issue and the crisis around healthcare costs, it did create the optics, at least, of two pots of human beings, the retirees and the active in service, as you say, in your parlance. And so that's a problem for any labor movement, I'd imagine, because there's a sense that we want to get the retirees. They need to do this so that we can have premium-free healthcare. That's what it looks like to a civilian on the outside.
And that was, in our discussions, it was everything's on the table if we can be smart and strategic. So I know Medicare Advantage, that name is a really bad name, right? Especially here in the city, even though now more than 50% of Americans across the country are in them. But what Medicare Advantage, the law allows you to do is, like, you and I could start we could design our own Medicare Advantage plan. You and I, we could form a company and design our own Medicare Advantage plan, and we could ask people if they want to be inside of it.
Bob and Mike's Medicare Advantage. I'll get Joe Namath to front it. I don't think it'll fly.
Once you put Medicare Advantage on it, well, the legal issue is it must say Medicare Advantage. So what we did was we said, we're going to design our own. We're not waiting for the insurance company. We're going to design our own. So we decided to design our own Medicare Advantage plan. And when that went out for bid, it was quite interesting because a lot of companies dropped off quickly because they were like, we're not agreeing to this. This is crazy. Because we have complete transparency. We get all the data from every procedure, every doctor's visit. We get the MLC in the city. We get all of the data. We would have our own department taking it apart. We're looking constantly for price gouging. We wouldn't agree unless they took 95% of the prior authorizations off. But that system is never going to be tested. So we can't prove that we really did something that would have worked, because it's never going to happen because of what the city needs to move away from this now. So, and the courts have said quite clearly, I mean, you've read those decisions.
Right.
I mean, it's pretty clear to me. So why do we keep beating this dead horse in the middle of the road?
Well, I guess the other key thing here is that it's not happening in isolation. And so it is 2024, the calendar turns. And when we spoke for the city and state story that I did, you pointed out that we're coming into this maybe the most critical presidential election since 1864. I wasn't around for it, although I sound like I might be. One of the things that is pivotal here is that we're not seeing healthcare, which really needs to be the number one labor issue in the country. It's not even being discussed. And can you talk about, because I have to say, when I went down with the cover of Marion Pizzitola and the retirees to Washington, I was surprised that there was such like Senator Warren, Congresswoman Joe Powell, like 30 or 40 members of Congress who were concerned about the concept of Medicare Advantage. And there was a lot of reporting, not about what you were doing, but about the way that this had been structured. And quite honestly, several reliable, not radical, not Marxist analysis, New York Times, Kaiser Health, Inspector General reports that said that Medicare Advantage model was problematic because the way it made money was by representing people for the purpose of coding to CMS, which is the cash register in the sky the government operates. They tell them that they had sick patients, and then on the back end, they made their profit. And this is the way the program works, by putting people through a kind of like Candyland prior authorization kind of maze. And so you were selling into that environment, right? I mean, that's what you were trying to. So I would imagine that all has to be factored into the resistance.
Yeah, right. But the main part of resistance was looking at all the other Medicare Advantage plans, which really we knew about all of these practices because we studied it. I was at the table at the very end. First, the city negotiated with the company, And then they came, to us, and the UFC was like, no. We said we were voting no. I mean, the MLC was ready to go at that point, and we held it up for another 2 months. And when Adams came in, they were all like, oh, the UFC is trying to block this. And we're like, no, we have to close every loophole that we know these companies do. And that's what we put inside of our plan. But you leave it out there for 2 years, and just people seeing what Medicare Advantage does, of course they're going to be fearful of it. And, you know, it doesn't matter if you have a good plan. Once you have that much, anxiety over a plan and it's completely now baked in, it's not going to work. So pull away from it. And when you talk about Washington, D.C., this is, you know, I've been talking about healthcare being our biggest issue for 12 years right now.
True.
And now, and you go to D.C., and it's like, great, President Biden's trying to deal with the pharmaceutical companies, but what are we doing? I mean, I get immigration is an important issue. I get what's going on in Israel and Palestine is horrible and a really important issue. But then the Republicans want to talk about inflation, but they don't want to talk about them not doing anything to stop the biggest inflationary problem that every family in America is dealing with, which is health care. And it's infuriating.
So I'm just wondering then, so Mike, what does the solution look like? I mean, I think you said to me something, a no-cost plan that's available to everyone that recognizes healthcare as a human right?
Yes, that is where we have to go. I mean, and at this point, you know, we're right now working with the AFT and Randy for over a month now because we know Medicare itself is under attack. We saw proposals this year in different budget processes where the Republicans wanted to just take a big bite out of Medicare. So we're working on legislation now, and we're hoping, like, right after this election, we can get it introduced. But it basically says that once you qualify for Medicare, that's it. You're in. And nobody can ever change what your benefits are inside of it. I mean, let's start there. Let's just take it off the table that people are going to threaten cutting Medicare for, you know, millions and millions of Americans who have earned that. And let's just start there. At this moment, I don't think you could do a big, I'm like, let's go after it piece by piece. Let's just start taking everything apart that these people are doing wrong and building a health care plan for all Americans that they would have access to.
And so I guess then looking ahead, now what's going to happen on the ground with the city?
Well, tomorrow the MLC has 3 meetings in a row. We had a meeting yesterday, and this was discussed, and it was decided that we would have 3 meetings in a row specifically on this subject, that what we're going to do. And it's not going to be easy, and we'll see what the MLC wants to do. But we've told them what our position is, and we're not backing down. And I know there are others who are going to be upset, but the thing is, if we can do this work, if we have a willing partner, we now know, you know, we know more about healthcare than any group of unions in the United States, because we've dug into it in ways that nobody else has. We know hospitals upcode. We know hospitals will change. You know, you got to know which center. Oh, I went to an urgent care center. Yeah, but it's actually.
And Mike, I don't want to interrupt, but you guys did something here that didn't get Julie Menin had that bill to provide transparency. And I guess that's another thing I just want to get in. You give me a minute on that, because that's an important piece here.
We push really hard because, as I said, we need transparency. So we got the bill passed. At first, it was opposition to it. But then we were able to push the bill through. And then in its first year, it's the hospital transparency bill. So that means
Right. Everything
a hospital does has to be reported to this new team or department inside of city council. The hospitals do not like this bill at all. Why? Because we're pulling back the veil, and we're going to see that the great Oz is not great.
I got to run, Michael. Thank you so much. I hope we can have you back, like, in a month or so.
That would be great.
All right. Thank you. That's Michael. All right. That's Michael Mulgrew, president of the UFT. We'll be right back after this. Union City Blues.
Time to
Union City Blues or Medicare Advantage Blues. You're listening to WBAI 99.5 FM Pacifica Radio in New York and New Jersey, streaming live online at WBAI.org. This show and our Moral Monday conversations with Reverend Dr. William Barber, all posted on the WBAI and WorkBytes websites, thanks to Joe Maniscalco and Debbie Daughtry. Right now, it's 71 degrees under sunny skies and clouds. Headed up to 90 degrees. Tomorrow, we'll break into the low 90s and have a 60% chance of scattered thunderstorms. Thursday, we're in the mid-60s to mid-80s range under a mix of sun and clouds. Fridays, the heat backs off as we drop into the 70s with the sun shining. Over the weekend, we're in the 70s and 80s with scattered showers. New York City's air quality is 52 or moderate, which means that sensitive groups with pre-existing respiratory or coronary issues should reduce outdoor exercise and wear a mask. Be sure to look in on elderly neighbors because the combination of high temperatures and degraded air quality can be life-threatening. This week's What's Going On, the Tuesday Labor Edition, is supported with listener dollars and a sustaining contribution from the Communications Workers of America of New Jersey, representing over 70,000 working families in the Garden State, fighting for both those in the private sector and public workers. We're also grateful for the United Steelworkers Local 4-200, representing nurses at Robert Wood Johnson University Hospital in New Brunswick, New Jersey. They're proud to support WBI and Pacifica Radio Network's labor programming. They know safer staffing saves lives, and they went on strike to get it. As their parent union says, it hasn't always been easy, but nothing worth doing is. In fact, the hottest fires forge the hardest steel. And of course, EMS Officers Union FDNY Local 3621 and its president, Lieutenant Vince Averielli, are proud to support the Tuesday edition of What's Going On, the Labor Radio Hour. Last year, FDNY EMS responded to over 1.6 million calls, the busiest year on record, a 14% spike from the peak of COVID. New York EMS Officers Union, FDNY and Local 3621 members are there for us when we need them most. We need to stand with them. EMS pay and benefit parity now. Saving lives shouldn't mean economic insecurity. And Mike Quills, of course, Transport Workers of America.
The Transport Workers Union fights the bosses for our 155,000 members across the economic spectrum. Airlines, mass transit, rail, school buses, bike share, tourism, university and utilities, even Central Park horse carriage drivers. I'm John Samuelson, International President of the Transport Workers Union. If you want a strong voice at the workplace, if you want to improve your life, join us. We are the TWU, America's Fight Back Union.
Oh, somebody's hurting my brother, and it's gone on far too long. Yes,
this is movement time, and when it's movement time, we can all be together.
Reverend Dr. William Barber.
We are here to announce on June the 29th at 10 o'clock on Pennsylvania and 3rd, we are calling for the Mass Poor People's Low Wage Workers Assembly and Moral March on Washington and to the polls, June 29, 2024. We're saying the last picture of D.C. ought not be people tearing the Capitol up and trying to tear democracy down. We need a picture of folk trying to build a democracy up and lift up all people, regardless of who they are, June the 29th. On Pennsylvania and 3rd.
And of course, we will be there thanks to a sustaining contribution from the American Federation of Government Employees and several other national unions. We start from 9 a.m. The event itself starts at 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Jana Flanagan, my colleague from WNYC, who did such a great job on Channel 13 Metro Focus, will be anchoring out of New York. Anyway, so it is just, it's great. We're going to have these folks on the Doctors Council like we did, Julie Dinella and the wonderful nurses at United Steelworkers 42-200 who led that amazing strike that went on month after month. Hopefully it doesn't come to that for the Doctors Council, but, it's an honor to invite Dr. Simonetta Sambataro. Good morning, doctor.
Good morning, Bob. It's always a pleasure to be here on the show with you.
Great. And a newbie, Dr. Runa Ray, also with the Doctors Council SEIU. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Okay, great. So, Dr. Cimitaro, let's catch people up a bit because, you know, people, it's episodic. People turn in. I said in the introduction that this comes at a time you haven't had a contract in a while. We've seen a real pop in admissions and emergency room visits. And so if you could just give us a sense of where we are, COVID is still an issue, although it's not a mass death event, but it still is something occupationally you all have to be concerned with. What is, give us a Polaroid snapshot. What's happening? And as I say, this amazing institution that we need to be proud of, that we should be proud of, Health and Hospitals Corporation.
Yes. So Health and Hospitals, as you know, is a big system. We have 11 hospitals throughout the boroughs, and we have 30 outpatient clinics, as well as 5 post-acute long-term care facilities, and we take care also of the correctional health system and the public schools with the nurses and doctors that serve them as well. We're about 2,800 doctors that fill all these positions. And as we said 2 weeks ago when we came on radio as well, is that we with the Doctors Council are fighting to recruit and retain doctors because we're losing doctors, I say left and right, and we need them for better patient care and a better health system that can serve all the people of New York. We have been in bargaining with Health and Hospitals since our contract ended in August 2023. We have not reached any agreement. The last proposal we submitted about in May were rejected. We asked for more bargaining dates. They haven't given us more bargaining dates. They came back to us with a framework of proposals. That framework is being reviewed by our bargaining committee, but it's very unsatisfactory, let me tell you. And
understood, especially after all you went through. Dr. Runa Ray, give us a little bit of a bio about yourself, how you came to Health and Hospitals, and how does this present circumstance impact you and your practice and the patients you see?
Thanks for asking. I'm a family doctor. I've been with the city hospital system since 2019, 5 years. And like many HHC doctors, I was attracted to working in the city hospital system by a sense of mission to working with poor and immigrant communities in New York. And I actually moved to live closer to the hospital because I wanted to live and work in the same community. I felt very proud of the social role I played being part of the public health system of New York City. In accepting this job, I actually took a big pay cut. And I turned down other jobs that that offered more money. But obviously not everyone can do this. And even for me now, I have children now, and I didn't when I started the job. It's harder for me to do it. So the HHC system loses a lot of potential doctors because of the lower pay and poorer benefits. There's a lot of physician vacancies in the system. We heard last time we were on. I heard from colleagues yesterday on a text thread about Queens Hospital losing 4 ER docs recently. At Jacoby Psychiatry, they have only 3 inpatient psychiatrists, whereas there were 12 8 years ago. They often fill vacancies with per diem doctors, which is poor quality care and often more expensive. At Lincoln Hospital, they said that they are hanging on by a thread with 1 retina specialist in ophthalmology. They used to have 3. At Jacoby North Central Bronx, a nephrology position has been open for over 2 years. There's no chief of pulmonary critical care for over 2.5 years. So there's more stories like this. And, you know, the most important thing for listeners to know is that patients experience this. You know, when doctors' jobs are not good, patients experience long wait times, weeks or months waiting for appointments, hours in the waiting room, unsafe staffing, overworked doctors, who have low morale, a low reserve of empathy, higher exhaustion, depression, burnout. You know, I didn't even mention the women's health vacancies. There's so many vacancies across the system in OB and OB specialties. And we hear a lot about the crisis in Black maternal mortality. And vacancies in women's health positions are open. And this is what institutional racism looks like, because the city hospitals see more people of color and immigrants and are dramatically under-resourced. So, you know, one of the things that the city hospital can do to improve the Black maternal mortality crisis is to improve physician jobs so that those OB positions can be filled. You know, bizarrely enough, I actually, in this setting of difficulty recruiting and retaining physicians, I was actually laid off recently, 2 weeks before giving birth. I'm currently on maternity leave, which is why I'm able to attend today. But I'm not being allowed to take my full maternity leave, including the state paid family leave, which doesn't actually cost anything for the employer. And, you know, I'm not sure why this happened. The position that I was laid off from was later advertised and I applied for it. But like many of my colleagues have mentioned, the position was advertised as a per diem position, which means there's no benefits. There's a position that I had within had benefits. I provided my family of five with health benefits. So if I do get this position, I'll have no benefits and will be, you know, have to get a second job for benefits. You know, the city hospital system should be providing good jobs for New Yorkers, not trying to erode the quality of jobs. As they are using per diem or it's called locums, like temporary physicians in so many positions around the city. And I'd like to think that maybe if I was employed directly by the city, I might be treated better, but I don't know. My employer and a lot of the physician, the employers of physicians in the city hospital system are actually private entities like Mount Sinai.
That's right. We covered that last time. It's kind of quirky. It goes back to Giuliani's era. It's kind of a weird arrangement.
Well, it has, it's actually older than that. From the, at least the Mount Sinai Agreement is from the 60s. NYU hires the Bellevue and Woodhull doctors, and they subcontract their physician services. You know, I don't know why these are giant corporations that have billions of dollars. Maybe it's a convenient way to turn a blind eye on unsavory labor practices. One of the problems that we've dealt with is that, you know, in part because of this bizarre subcontracting system, we don't have a single contract across the city, across the 12 hospitals and clinics that Dr. Samatero mentioned. So doctors doing different things in different hospitals actually have, doing the same thing in different hospitals have different pay and benefits. And that's one of the things that we're asking for, parity, so that like a hematologist in Elmhurst Hospital makes the same and has the same benefits as one in Lincoln Hospital. Right now, we don't really have like a real contract. It's just like a hodgepodge of documents. And it makes it harder, actually, for the public health system to respond, for example, to emergencies like in the COVID pandemic, because it's harder to shift physicians around the system as needed. We've asked for a single contract across the city and parity in pay, and we have been denied, as Dr. Sambataro mentioned. You know, so some based on my experiences, some of the things I'd like to see are you know, a contract unified across the city, equal pay and benefits, a real protected parental leave, seniority clause, and, you know, many other things.
Sounds like a mess. I mean, I got to say, I'm going to have to play the Reverend Barber clip. You guys depress me. I've made a commitment to have you on, but I'm feeling very bummed out today.
Well, you know, there's a positive way to look at it, Bob. And okay,
I'm open. Let's see you turn that around, Doctor.
All right, well... you know, Mitch Katz, he's the head of the New York City Health and Hospitals Corporation. He's a physician in the system. And he has said that he supports a single-payer system and the New York Health Act, which is a bill for a state single-payer system. I'm with a group called Physicians for a National Health Program. I'm a vice chair there. It's a voluntary position. I don't get paid for it. And, you know, I want to say to Dr. Katz, this is his chance to advocate for a single-payer healthcare system in New York State. You know, instead of nickel and diming the doctors and especially the patients at New York City Health and Hospitals, he can turn around and stand up for us, for the physicians who run the system and for the patients especially. The city budget discussions are closing this week. Dr. Katz, you can tell the mayor that we need more funds for the health of New Yorkers and, frankly, less for the police department. He can tell the governor that she needs to pass the New York Health Act. And he can say that, you know, it's not him. It's the 3,000 doctors of the city hospital system. That can't and won't tolerate the segregated conditions that we're practicing in for ourselves or our patients. You know, doctors are leaving the system as individuals because we can't provide a good standard of care. You know, in the last week, our union held three rallies, and I went to all three of them with my kids. Jacoby in the Bronx, Elmhurst in Queens, where I live, and South Brooklyn hospitals. And I saw hundreds of doctors who are taking a stand against this broken system. When patient care suffers as it is now, when there's racism and segregation in healthcare, when we can't do our jobs, sometimes we're forced to slow down the system, to pause the billing we do, and to take a break until our patients get the health care they deserve and until we get a patient contract.
I want to give the number of calls if you're a patient, if you're a healthcare professional, if this resonates with you, if you have some ideas, 212-209-2877, 212-209-2877. Dr. Sommataro, as a practical matter, it's possible because of what Runa describes, because of this patchwork, you could theoretically, you have a big chunk of talented physicians that aren't covered under the Taylor law. Like, looking ahead, there could be a strike. I mean, it wouldn't be illegal, right?
No, it wouldn't. For the physicians that, and there are about 2,200 physicians that are under the affiliate, which is separate from the H&H physicians. And the city, as you mentioned before, did that. So they would not pay us the lifelong health insurance and give us a pension. So we could strike because we are not really considered city employees, although all our benefits are shifted from the city to the affiliates to us. So the affiliates do not have any say on how much money they get from the city. And so it's sort of a crazy system. It really makes it very hard to understand. But yes, we could strike. We have growing numbers of physicians that now are asking to be strike ready. And I think it's not out of line to say that if H&H continues to disregard us and disrespect us, and disrespect New Yorkers, really, because... Wow. We are here to serve them, and when the infrastructure is not working because they didn't put money in it, it's hard. It's not only us that, you know, are suffering. There's staff issues also with the, clerks and
it's system wide. I mean, from what you tell me, it is. It's, and I have to say. Dr. Ray, I just would also want to add, there's a little thing called the stock transfer tax. Nobody likes to talk about it in polite company, particularly politicians dependent on campaign contributions for Wall Street. But the craziness about this is, back in 1907, a Republican governor put on the books 10 cents per $100 tax for all stock transfers that were going on. It's been on the books in London since 1697. And in the 1980s, some people decided to start rebating it back to Wall Street. And do you know, doctors, we've rebated $400 billion back since. And so when politicians wring their hands like, oh, wealth inequality is such a problem. What can we do about it? Oh, I don't know. What should we do? I'm confused. I need to cash this check from Jamie Dimon, but I really don't want to collect this dime. I mean, Dr. Ray, it's just crazy that this money's around, and you're telling me, like, the cost to humanity from the deferred decisions and poor quality healthcare, what the city of New York is doing is long-term, immoral, unethical, should be indictable, and is tremendously costly to society.
It's true. And, you know, since the 1980s, the number of managers has gone up about 40 times, and the number of doctors has gone up about twice. I just want to go back to something that Simonetta was saying about striking. Sometimes people are scared of striking. What does that mean for a healthcare system? And I just want to do a little education. Doctor strikes are common, and it doesn't mean that we leave people bleeding out on the table to die. So I just want to reassure both the public and my colleagues that this is not what happens. You know, a doctor strike had happened last year at Elmhurst Hospital in Queens among the residents. It happens frequently in other countries, in the UK, in New Zealand, in Greece, when the conditions that we practice under are not tenable for good care. And what happens in a doctor strike is that basically we just kind of pare back on staffing the way we do at night, overnight staffing and weekend staffing. So we kind of pare back and we take turns going outside, you know, just to show that, you know, that we can't sustain these conditions anymore.
Absolutely. We've got to get to a caller. I got to get to a caller. Excuse me. I'm so sorry, but there are stockholders. Go ahead, caller. Where are you calling from? What's on your mind and what's your name?
Hi, my name is Dorothy Mansell. I'm calling from Little Neck, New York.
Go ahead. What's on your mind?
Oh, I tuned in late. You were speaking to Michael Mulgrew, and you guys are supporting Medicare Advantage?
No. He was here to announce that Medicare Advantage, they've abandoned that decision because the majority of retirees overwhelmingly voted to have the union reverse course, which they are.
Right.
I'm so sorry. Thank you. So I've got up against a break, but do call again. And so what can we do to support our doctors? Dr. Ray, what can we do tangible? Give us some homework.
You can call the mayor's office and call HHC, Mitch Katz, and tell them to fully fund the New York hospital system. You can call the governor and your state representative and tell them to support the New York Health Act. We have a website you can go to sign a petition. Do you have it, Simonetta? I'm sorry.
Yeah, the website where you can write to the mayor.
It's doctorsforall.org.
Yeah,
sorry.
Correct.
Doctorsforall.org. And that's just a petition asking Mayor Adams to fully fund H&H. But, you know, we have to end the segregation in the healthcare system, the racism in the healthcare system. We have to staff better. You know, we as doctors, we provide the majority of the billing for the hospital system. That's billions of dollars. You know, we can slow it down if we need to in order to negotiate a fair contract. You know, doctors can write their notes, provide their patient care, and just, you know, spend a day not signing their notes. And that means the billing is not done for a day.
That's right. Dr. Sommatero, can we get somebody on to keep the pressure on next Tuesday or maybe Monday with Reverend Barber? What do you think? Can we get some people?
I'll try and get somebody. Sure.
We got to keep it going because, it's very powerful. And we're going to be with you to the duration. We're going to just keep doing it. And we'll circulate these name and numbers to other programmers at BI because these conversations, folks, this is the only place this is happening, right? It's the only place where healthcare is number one. Thanks so much for taking the time and joining us today.
Problem.
Thank you, Bob.
It's a pleasure.
Yes, thank you, Dr. Sommatero and Dr. Runa Ray. That's it for us. I just wanted to remind you that thanks to a major donation from the American Federation of Government Employees, union representing 750,000 federal workers, the Pacifica Radio Network will be covering live the June 29th Mass Poor People's Low Wage Workers Assembly and Moral March on Washington, D.C. in the polls. Coverage starts at 9 a.m. We want to hear from you during that hour about how we can make this 2024 campaign about the American people. It'll be anchored by Jenna Flanagan, award-winning news anchor and investigative journalist, as well as a former host of PBS's WNET's Metro Focus. Why did they have to get rid of that? I love that show. Anyway, we'll be taking listener calls. Democracy Now! Is up next. And remember, we get the world we fight for nonviolently.
party. Can you make it free? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Let me see your Bible. You do, I'm a do too.
Everybody. WBAI, New York.
Take these broken wings and learn to fly all your life. You were only waiting for this moment to rise. Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these sunken eyes and learn to see all your life. You were only waiting for this moment to free.
Blackbird, the Beatles, for Julian Assange here on WBAI. We're at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. That special request. Happy to be able to do it. Coming up to the top of the hour here in New York City, Democracy Now! Is coming up next, and I know you'll be staying tuned for that. Right after that, there is Law of the Land. The executive producer is Gloria J. Brown Marshall. Today, Professor Linda McDonald Carter will be sitting in. Looking forward to that as well. Minefield with Dr. James McIntosh, that's at 10 o'clock. Exploration, Science and Peace Issues with Dr. Michio Kaku. So much radio ahead over this, once again, as I always say, as we all always say, listener-sponsored, commercial-free radio station, WBAI. Visit our website at WBAI.org and make a contribution to support this effort, to support your continued and ongoing access to information. That's right, your access to information. You don't have to pay a subscription. You don't have to make a subscription monthly to do it. Now, of course, we'd love for you to become a sustaining member if you can, or become a first-time subscriber for a $25 pledge. If you can, become a major donor, if you can, a $500 contribution. Democracy Now! Is coming up next. Please stay tuned.